Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and to help me navigate through all the news from the world of super yachting are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. A little later in this week's podcast, you can hear Charlotte's interview with Jeremy Jauncey, a travel influencer, I suppose. Is that what you'd call him? In fact, well, instead of me trying to explain it, Charlotte, why don't you tell us more about Jeremy?
Sure. Well, I think he'd probably shudder at being called an influencer. But if you look at his personal account, you'll find lots of pictures of him looking sickeningly in shape on glamorous beaches all over the world. So there's an element of that. But essentially, he's an entrepreneur. He founded an Instagram account called Beautiful Destinations. You've probably heard of it. I had already followed it before I'd heard of him. But it posts kind of amazing travel pictures from all over the world, and people send them in and they sort of repost them. Anyway, the account has over 14 million followers, and that's just on Instagram alone. So once you have Facebook and TikTok and all the other platforms they're on, it's an audience of over 25 million people. And he sort of consults for different tourist boards and companies and individuals. But I just thought he'd be interesting to talk to you, largely because next year, if and when travel picks up, which we all hope it will, the competition between owners chartering their yachts is going to be fiercer than ever. He told us later in the podcast, you'll hear, he's already seen a huge uptick in sort of adventure travel in interest in the second half of the year. So people don't want city breaks. They don't want crowded beaches. They want to escape other people. So there's going to be a lot more demand, hopefully, than there was before. And if you need more proof that this is happening, I spoke to someone from Wyco for a piece the other day, and they said the same thing. Essentially, they've seen a 34% increase in online inquiries for Greenland and 20% for Antarctica compared to last year. So anyway, the interest is there, but he's going to just give a little masterclass in how best to sell yourself, how best to sell your yacht, what social media platform to use and why that one in particular. And also, if you're not planning on chartering your yacht, he's also just got some really good tips on how to take better pictures. So if you're on board over the festive period, you can take some fantastic selfies. But apparently it's all in what time of day you're taking the picture. So no boozy after lunch selfies because it's too bright. You have to do first thing in the morning or at sundown at 1 o'clock, apparently.
Well, thank God, finally, someone is going to tell me how to take a selfie because I can never quite master it. So first, I'm not good. First thing in the morning. I don't look good. I'm not in a good mood. So I'm not sure that's optimum selfie taking timing for Stuart Campbell. But I don't know. Maybe I'll give it a go tomorrow morning and post it and you guys can let me know what you think.
I like that idea. Vote live on Stuart's first thing in the morning selfie. We can have it on Instagram. Did this turn out well? Yes or no?
No, you know not to talk to Stuart before about 9:45 in the morning. I think that's the first thing you learn when you start working at Boat International. It's just a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah, not a morning person. Definitely not. Maybe when's the other optimum selfie time in the evening?
I think it's sort of sundowner time. Basically, you want soft light.
I do need soft light. That's definitely true.
Not you personally. one wants soft lighting, I mean. Now, you can listen to the interview. You can see for yourself. He's talking about people in general.
Okay, sounds good. Right, you might have noticed it's almost Christmas, and we have, as I've mentioned before on the podcast, a few gift guides on the website to help you get that present for the person who has everything, and for the children who have everything. We've also got a gift guide for your kids. So if a super yacht owner still looking for that perfect gift, some of these things are really amazing. And I, of all of them, I had to pick this one out. My favorite is a mini Aston Martin DB5, which is made, there's a company called the Little Car Company, and they basically make these beautiful recreations, but scaled down of famous cars. They did this kind of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang kind of one previously, but now they've done a DB5. It costs £35,000. Ooh. And that's the base model. And it comes with 5 kilowatts of installed power and even has a race setting. So perhaps not one for your toddler. So there you go. If you're scurrying around and you can't get hold of a PlayStation 5 because they're all sold out everywhere, £35,000 buys you a very beautiful but small Aston Martin DB5. How about that?
I find those sort of sports cars for tiny kids terrifying. One of the scariest sights I've ever seen was a toddler going down the high street in an electric pink convertible, wearing a fur coat and shades. And she kind of had one hand on the steering wheel and she's just kicking back. And just the amount of power she had was terrifying. I was thinking, my God, she's got more swagger than kind of rappers in their 40s. It's just, you know, immense, but scary.
Yeah. Yeah, just thinking about the yacht in the south of France, no doubt, as she's cruising down in her pink convertible. For a more grown-up Christmas gift, how about this? So I got a press release the other day from our friends at Cooks and Adventures. So they're talking up a gift package they've put together, and it's a submarine training experience in Curaçao. So they're calling it the world's coolest track day. So the thing with these super yacht subs is they usually require trained pilots. So it's not like you can just buy one, stick it on your super yacht, jump in and take off. It's not quite as easy as that. This course, however, gets you behind the wheel of a U-Boat Works submersible. You can dive shipwrecks in nearby Aruba and check out the region's amazing marine life, which is genuinely spectacular. So what's the cost? So it's a bit more expensive than the Aston Martin DB5. This is $92,000 and it's for a 7-day trip. Sadly, super yacht is not included. So you've got to get yourself there or charter a yacht to run alongside the course. But if you are interested in learning how to pilot a submersible, this is a pretty good way, crash course in getting beneath the waves. And talking about cool toys, so this weekend on our social media channels, you'll be able to see the ultimate tender face-off between two design studios. So we've basically asked a couple of design studios to design the ultimate explorer tender. As you might have been paying attention throughout the year, we've run these design competitions with studios. I think we've done four or five of them now. So this is ending the year with this really cool one. So Radica, which is based in the US, actually Mexico, I think, and H2 Yacht Design from the UK have both designed the coolest super yacht tenders you can possibly imagine. So your job is to vote on which one you think is the best. So we'll be putting some information about each of the designs up on the website and also on our social media channels. So please do check those out.
It's a really tough one, that design challenge between the two of those designs. Having had a little preview, I think it's a tough one. But once you've placed your vote on that, if you've got our January issues through your postbox, then you can do our Christmas quiz or our end of year quiz. And I thought to round the year off, I would ask you guys some questions, seeing as Stuart has been kind of grilling Caroline and I thought time for the tables to turn. And you don't actually know all of the answers, so this is going to be great. Number one, what is a phrase meaning depressed or miserable taken from a region of the sea? Fastest finger first. I think you need buzzers.
Well, it's the doldrums. Yeah. Right?
One to Stew. For a bonus point, where are the doldrums and what is unique about this area?
I'm going to continue my losing streak here, but I'm going to guess Turkey because it sounds a bit like Bodrum.
I think that's wrong.
I think the doldrums are in the Atlantic, and I think they're somewhere off the coast of South America, somewhere deep into the Atlantic off the coast of South America.
And that's why you're the editor. There we go.
It's an intertropical convergence zone, so no one gets points for naming that snazzy title, which is basically a belt around the equator. And it suffers from a lack of wind, so you can get stuck there, stuck in the doldrums, stuck feeling depressed. Number two. Okay, one to Stew. Film star who owned at least four yachts, most famously Sarita. He changed his surname from Coppola to avoid accusations of nepotism. He is the nephew of Godfather director Francis Ford Coppola.
I think I know this one.
Go!
I've got no idea.
I think it's Nicolas Cage.
It is! What all? Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage is, Nick Cage has owned four yachts.
Yes, fantastic. Apparently so.
Yeah. I know the trashy ones.
All right, two more questions to go. Everything to win. Number three, Armel's recently revealed it was building its biggest ever boat, a 120-metre project known as Project Signature, due for delivery in 2025. It will be even larger than the yard's current flagship, which took its name from a Beatles classic written by George Harrison. What's the song?
Buzz.
Yeah.
This is easy. Well, Here Comes the Sun, obviously.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Caroline knew that one as well.
I wrote the feature on that one.
But there you go.
She wrote the song. All right, last one. The 93-metre Lady S is the first yacht to contain which piece of entertainment technology?
Buzz.
Buzz. I think we, yeah.
So I don't know who overall won that. I think it goes to show that you've both done your homework. One all? No, two all? Three all? Don't know.
A clear victory for me, I think. That much is obvious.
I think Caroline's doing that diplomatic thing like when you let people win at tennis. She's held back on the buzzing so that she can diplomatically.
Okay.
Good politics. Good politics.
Managing upwards.
But am I right in thinking all... So that the Christmas quiz will be online or on our social channels over the Christmas period. Is that right?
So there's going to be some questions popping up on Instagram. There's some in the magazine. It will no doubt be online at some point as well. I say if you've got the magazine, do it there because you can see some incredible pictures and you can, write as you go through. But it's good to test your knowledge and see what you remember. And my favorite round is about kind of sailing phrases. So it's not just the doldrums. There's a whole section on it. And it's fascinating to see how many things come from yachts and sailing and what their origins are, I think.
Actually, I've got one. Because we did a feature a while back as well about nautical phrases. Maybe it was from, I can't remember, but do you know what square meal? Do you know where this phrase square meal comes from?
No.
It's the plate. Wasn't it sort of the plates on the ship were nailed down onto the bench and you'd get your food in the little square?
I thought it was because on old ships, you get, the plates weren't circular. They were square because they're made for easy stacking and they wouldn't roll around. I thought that was it. Oh, God, I hope that's right. I could be wrong, but I think that's where square meal came from. Anyway, I think it's in the same feature, so hopefully it will appear and I can be told I'm right or wrong online, which is always fun. All righty, here with the news. Caroline, talk us through it.
Thank you. So San Lorenzo has revealed new designs for the new flagship of its SL line. That's the 36.9-meter SL120. Taking the yard's asymmetric layout to new lengths, the model follows in the footsteps of the 31-metre SL-102. The boat's asymmetric design features a single deck on one side, matched on the opposite side by a wide-body design. So you might be familiar with this from a previous San Lorenzo. The concept for these boats was first announced in 2015 with the American car designer Chris Bangle, although both the SL-102 and the SL-120 were actually designed by Zukon International Project.
So way back, it feels like in the mists of time now, I went out to see, so Chris Bangle, amazingly creative guy. So he was working with San Lorenzo 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. Anyway, so I went up to he's got this kind of mountaintop creative kind of commune almost. It feels like that where he lives and all his staff work and the mountains above Milan. I think it's Milan. But it was just the most amazing experience. You hear Google, some of these big software companies have these places where they just dump all the most creative minds and they say, go and just invent and be creative and go do crazy things. And it felt a bit like that. It was just this most amazing atmosphere. And he had built this pool that kind of out over the Milanese countryside that was suspended in midair. It was fantastic. It's the wild place of creativity. Yeah, Chris, really, really, really interesting guy. Formerly the design director of BMW, obviously, for the longest time. So responsible for some of BMW's most iconic designs.
God, how interesting. I love it when shipyards and designers get outsiders in to kind of inject their take on things. It always leads to interesting projects.
Yeah, it really does, yeah.
So in other Italian yard news, Rossi Navi has announced the delivery of the 52-metre yacht Florentia, which was launched from its Pisa yard in June. The full displacement yacht was sold in October 2017 and features an exterior by Carlo Colombo and the A++ design studio, and an elegant and sinuous, I'm quoting here, exterior design by Giorgio and Stefano Vaffiardis. It looks like quite an appealing interior in neutral tones, and the main staircase looks really spectacular with leather, pale carved wood, and some beautiful metallic touches.
So this boat came out of the Rossi Navi shed that's near Pisa Airport. It's always a bit weird. You kind of, when you're driving to Pisa Airport, and for the record, I can't stand Pisa Airport, but we could talk about that more at another time. So when you're driving to Pisa Airport, there's this kind of almost random Rossi Navi shed in the middle of nowhere. and with the canal next to it, it always kind of, I was thinking, oh wow, and there's always a couple of yachts sticking around outside there. So that's quite a big yacht to come out of that shed. So it's a good looking boat too. Well, good on Rossi Navi. Yeah.
Lovely kind of classic lines. Good looking. Yeah. Then the third piece of news I have for you is that Southern Wind's 30-meter RP Nauta 100 custom sailing yacht Morgana has departed the South African shipyard for her maiden journey. I'm mainly mentioning this because I think you should go to our website and look at the pictures because they're very cool. The yacht has begun a 7,500 nautical mile journey to the Mediterranean, where the owners will take delivery. Morgana was commissioned by an experienced yachtsman and is designed inside and out by Nauta Design, with naval architecture by Rachel Pugh. The two previously collaborated on Southern Wind's first custom sailing yacht, All Smoke, which was delivered in 2017. The brief for this yacht called for a very fast performance cruiser with an aggressive and sporty aesthetic. The result is a powerful 63-ton all-carbon racer cruiser with a lifting keel, elegant flush deck, and a large sail area for performance. She is unmistakable with a dark hull and rigging and a neon green cockpit.
Yeah, I saw the green. Hell of a design. Really pings, doesn't it? Absolutely. Yeah, definitely go and check out those pictures. All righty, thanks for that, Caroline. And now, what's the data story?
Well, we have touched on this before in recent podcasts, but we thought we'd go properly in depth this week. So our global order book has now been officially revealed in the January issue of Boat International, which is out right now. The global order book is essentially the industry's annual health check, a thorough rundown of superyachts in build or on order at shipyards all around the world as of September the 1st, 2020. So to give you an idea of some of the top line numbers, 821 projects are ordered or under construction. That compares to 807 last year, so that seems better on paper. Although I should note that, as discussed last week, it actually reflects many delayed projects too. The total length under construction for all builders is 33,151 metres. That's a growth of 1.7% on last year's number. 39% of projects are being built on spec compared to 43% last year. And that's a good thing since it means that more of the boats have owners.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was quite interesting statistic, or just a figure to pick out from this year's report, the fact that there just seems to be a slightly lessening appetite for speculative risk out there amongst shipyards with the number of the global order book built on spec without owners, basically.
Yeah.
In the hope of getting them through construction, that there's fewer of them, which is interesting.
Absolutely understandable in a year like 2020. Mm. There are overall more active shipyards, 179 of them, than there were in last year's global order book when there were 170. But 87 of those are building only one 24 meter plus project. The top country by total length is Italy, which has 407 projects and a total length of 14,994 metres in build. That's followed by the Netherlands with 74 and Turkey with 76 projects. In terms of average length, the Netherlands is at 60 metres, whereas Italy is at 37 and Turkey is at 46. Sticking to countries, the biggest growth was seen in the Turkish industry, which was up 12%. That's possibly because, like Taiwan, which is in fourth place, the country was less impacted by COVID-19.
Yeah, Turkey seems to have done a pretty good job of, you don't hear many horror stories about COVID coming out of Turkey. Similarly, Taiwan, they just dealt with it very, very effectively.
Absolutely. So turning to the types of project that are in build or on order, all categories have kept a good level since last year, including sailing yachts, which often don't fare so well. It's worth noting that explorer yachts continue to grow, which links up with something that Charlotte was mentioning earlier about trends towards more adventurous destination. So that's explorer yachts. The number of explorer yachts in build has increased by about 9.4% over the last year. Another growth spot is support vessels, with no fewer than six currently in build around the world, from Australia to the Netherlands, Spain, and Turkey.
We've got a really interesting feature coming up about that shortly, actually. I'll go into it in more detail on another podcast, but it's fascinating to see how owners use their support vessels in different ways, whether it's kind of, using one boat to go to one place and another to go to another so that they can fly from one to another and cover a lot more ground, or whether it's having them side by side and switching between the two. Like, it's a really, really good read, that piece, and I look forward to telling you more about it later.
Yeah, that sounds great. Look forward to that one. Well, turning to the impact of COVID in general, we should reiterate that that delays because of COVID have affected numbers. In short, they may be making this year's numbers look rather healthier than they actually are. So usually delayed projects represent 5 to 10% of the global order book production. This time it was 19.4% or 159 projects. But despite that, given the potential impact of this year's pandemic, the numbers do seem pretty decent. And I should note that the official deadline for data for the global order book was the 1st of September. So if you need up-to-the-date figures on this kind of thing, do log into our markets intelligence platform, Boat Pro, where you can get the very, very, very latest data on the super yacht industry.
Thanks for that, Caroline. As ever, some really interesting insights into the state of the super yacht industry. So next week's podcast is a little different, because early this year I got to spend a day with Jonathan Beckett, the CEO of Burgess, and we had a really great conversation just about his 40 years in the industry. So it wasn't about the state of the industry or the COVID's impact on the industry or anything like that. It was just trying to extract and mine some of the amazing stories that Joff has from his long career in super yachting and being involved in some of the biggest deals in yachting history, really, and working with people like Donald Trump. So he sold Trump his boat and then sold the boat for Trump. And just that story alone is worth watching the video for. It's really good. So the video is live now on our website. But if you don't want to watch the video, we are pulling the audio out and be running the audio alone as a podcast next week. So don't miss that. And then we'll take a little break and be back. I think it's on the 7th of January for all the usual news and views from the world of super yachting. So check out our interview with Joff next week. And then we'll see you on the 7th of January in a hopefully slightly more optimistic 2021. Right. That's enough from me. Over to Charlotte's interview with Jeremy Jauncey.
So today I'm joined by Jeremy Jauncey. If you don't know him already, now's the time to get clicking. You'll find him on Instagram as the founder of a business called Beautiful Destinations, which currently has 14.1 million followers, which blows my mind a bit. In fact, he's a man with a social media audience of over 25 million people, eating out of the palm of his hand. And some people say he has the best job in the world. So today we're going to find out. Hello, Jeremy.
Morning. Thank you for having me, Charlotte.
Morning. No, thanks for coming on. So my first question is, where in the world are you today? It doesn't look like you're on a tropical island from what I can see at the moment.
Nothing exciting. Nothing too exciting. I'm in London. I'd spent the first half of the year in New York, where I'd been based for the last sort of 4 years. Came back to London. I've always had a place here. Home is the UK. My mum's up in Edinburgh in Scotland. And so I've come back to London for Christmas.
Ah, lovely. Well, not a bad place to be. I mean, obviously, we've got the new restrictions, but hope you have a nice day anyway, as we're building up to it. So let's start off by explaining a bit more about what you do. So it's easy for people to see if you go on the channel, but it's basically hundreds of amazingly beautiful images of sort of turquoise waters and the kind of photographs that essentially you see and you just want to be there. But what's the business model? How does this actually work for you?
Yeah, of course. So there are two very distinct parts to the business. And I'll start with the piece you just described, which, to be honest, is what most people tend to know us for. Over the last 5 years, we've built one of the largest travel communities online in the world, if not the largest dedicated sort of tourism following on social media specifically. You mentioned at the beginning, there's around 25 million people, I think actually more than that now, that come every single day to the different platforms that we run, really to be inspired about travel. And I think the best parallel that I can give is certainly as a generation that grew up watching TV and reading magazines and looking at printed or traditional media, has moved into a generation now that finds its world news, its inspiration, its connection with friends and families through a mobile device. We've seen this explosion of social media really become a powerful sort of media entity in its own right. And that's really what that community represents for us. So that side of our business allows us to work with amazing brands and help them to activate on social media as they would if they were advertising, as they would as if they were building their brands. But the other part of the business was actually not quite as high profile, but significantly bigger, and really the kind of beating heart from a revenue and a financial standpoint is as a strategy and content agency. And that really means sitting down with brands across travel and travel adjacencies to talk about them, about how they make content, and really that wealth of opportunity that exists in tapping into these platforms and tapping into mobile and tapping into social, and realizing that today you have to be making content on all platforms at all times. The way you used to traditionally advertise doesn't work in the way that it used to. There are very, very different ways to engage customers and drive sales. And through the lens of content, that's what our business does.
Amazing. So we'll come on to that in a bit more detail later. So funny hearing you talking about kind of that's where the new generation go for travel inspiration. I remember the days where I go out with my mum and dad and get a whole pile of catalogues and kind of pour through images of travel brochures. And I was thinking, where did I used to go for travel inspiration? And it's so natural to us now to kind of scroll through Instagram. You forget that it wasn't always the case.
Absolutely.
But how did you get into it? Because I read up on you online, and I read that at one stage you were sort of training to become a rugby player in New Zealand. So
yes.
They seem like very disparate things. How did you end up here? And what was the sort of pathway that led to this this huge account and audience?
Yes, so very, very different background. When I was growing up, rugby was my biggest passion. I actually played rugby for Scotland whilst I was at school. Really had sort of committed my life to being a professional athlete. And actually my first real travel experience, like real big overseas travel experience, was because of rugby. And as you said, it was because I moved to New Zealand and spent almost two years training there and building a life there. And the long story short is that I was injured to the extent that I couldn't continue a professional career and was forced to sort of rethink what I wanted to do. So I came back to London, went to King's College studying business, and really only lasted a year because in that first summer, I actually did start a business. I fell in love with digital. I fell in love with e-commerce and started to learn that I was doing more hands-on, impactful work actually building this business myself than perhaps I was sitting in a classroom and learning. So I did that first year of university and then said to my my tutors, listen, hold my position for a year if you can. I'm going to go and start a business. If it doesn't work out, I will come back and finish the course. And if it does, then, you know, you'll be able to say you had a student that actually applied what they learned. And you know, we can find a way to tell a positive story about it. And thankfully, that business was successful. I ran it for 7 years. We went through the process of raising large amounts of venture capital, going from a handful of us to, I think at our peak, it was maybe 300 or 400 employees across the world. And really, I got a sort of firsthand learning from about 21 to 28 in how you build digital businesses. And so that, I think, set the pathway for how I think about travel. And really, when I got into Beautiful Destinations at the very, very beginning, it wasn't designed to be a business. And so for those that are listening that will remember the early days of social media, certainly the early days of Instagram, you could only post a square photo. There were no video. There was no, certainly no commerce. There was really very little interaction with other communities on the platform. Messaging, I think, was there, but not really to a huge degree. And so I just had a belief. Well, I think two things. One was a very, very strong belief that travel was a force for good in the world, that it was a very much a unifying industry where you meet amazing people, regardless of your age or your gender or your income or your nationality. And certainly all of the things that we're reading about in the mainstream media that have been dividing us, I've always felt that travel was a force that would bring people together. And if I could inspire people to travel, I could have a positive impact on the world, but actually also really celebrate an industry that's rooted in, you know, very emotive experiences. You know, there's not a single person that you can't sit next to in a bar or meet on a plane. Or, you know, if you're on the bus and you look to me and say, can you think of a single positive travel experience? Everybody has something, you know, there's always a point of reference to talk about. And so I loved that as an industry and just felt like there would be an opportunity to build a business around this community of people that back then in the early days of social media were just showing their perspective of the world and expressing their creativity through photographs. And then that community grew and grew and grew. And it really was sort of by chance that it became the business and it became the success that it has.
I totally understand that. You find that with yacht owners, where it's a kind of beautiful sailing boat or kind of huge catamaran or whatever. Mm-hmm. The thing that unites everyone is, you know, love of travel and going to beautiful mm-hmm. places. And mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what background you're from, what kind of traveling you like to do. It's something everyone connects with, which is a wonderful thing.
Exactly.
So what's the kind of the harder part of your job? Because I think for lots of people who kind of look at this and think, well, it's pretty easy to pick some amazing pictures. I could do that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's not quite that simple. What's the sort of more challenging element of what you do?
Yeah, so the business side of it, to be honest, is what I'm really passionate about. It's what I love. I really enjoy building businesses. And so the front end mm-hmm. social media that people see is essentially the shop window that allows us really to monetize, like I said, a strategy and content agency that ends up working with tourism boards, hotels, airlines, others within the travel industry, and actually just sits down and says, what are the challenges that you're facing? So many of them are saying, well, how do I actually drive a business return out of digital and social? How do I make the content that I need to be relevant on all these platforms? What even content should I make? And is there a difference between what I might put on my Instagram account and if I'm going to be putting something on YouTube? And then how different would that be to what I put on my website? And so the logistics of helping clients think through that is challenging because everyone has a unique problem. But then also the challenges of running creative teams. I'm not an especially creative person. I'm more of an entrepreneurial business-minded person. And so working with creative teams is challenging. And I think certainly in the course of the last 12 months, it's been about as challenging an environment that I've ever faced in my life. And I'm sure many of us in the travel industry are feeling the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk a bit more about that later as well. But it's been such a weird year for anyone in the travel business, whether it's yachts or flying or hotels or, you know, no one could have seen this coming. But let's talk a bit about your travel background as well as your business background. So what was, you know, were you someone who was always going on amazing holidays as a kid? Were you someone who was always going on little adventures, or did that really all kick off in New Zealand? Where did your kind of love of travel come from?
Yes. So I guess if I go way back, my father is Scottish and I grew up in Scotland, and that's sort of where I feel like my roots are. But my mother is mm-hmm. Is South American. She's Colombian, and she came over to the UK when she was very young. And so I grew up in a multicultural household, really with a perspective of the world that was very much about you know, understanding and celebrating people's differences and recognizing actually how much better we can be as people or societies or family units or friends when you embrace diversity and you really do understand that it doesn't matter where a person comes from. And so I think with that background, I went out into the world really believing that inherently everyone that I was going to encounter would have some element of positivity to them. And if I gave that sort of benefit of the doubt approach when I went out into the world, then good things would happen. So I didn't actually have a childhood where I was on lots and lots of nice holidays. I don't think I really had the appreciation for travel until I was 17 or 18 when I left Scotland to go to New Zealand. And I went via Singapore. And I think that first experience going to Southeast Asia was the thing that really opened my mind to how amazing travel was. Because I grew up on a farm in Scotland. You know, it was really just our family on that farm. We were in the middle of nowhere. It was a pretty sheltered upbringing where all I really did was play with my brother, play rugby, and not really see that much of the world. But going to Singapore and thinking, wow, this is a hugely multicultural, vibrant city that is as far away from, you know, where I grew up in Scotland as you could almost imagine. And the people are still friendly. They're amazing. They have great experiences that I'd never get back home. That was sort of the first, I guess, insight for me that travel was something that I deeply cared about. And then going from Singapore, going on to New Zealand, I actually ended up in Christchurch. And for anyone listening that has been to New Zealand or has been to Christchurch, there are a lot of parallels between that part of the world and parts of rural Scotland where I grew up. Very strong kind of farming communities, very strong sport and rugby communities. And really, I felt like, look, I've come to this side of the world, but in many ways, I've landed in a place that is just so similar to where I grew up, that actually there must be a bigger and broader world out there and I should get out and see more of it. So I'd say it was around that time in my life where I really started to fall in love with travel and realize the power of it. And equally just meeting different cultures. I think that's something that anyone that travels can relate to, because meeting Singaporeans and meeting Southeast Asians and just seeing how warm and welcoming and friendly they were, despite being so incredibly different to me. And then landing in New Zealand and meeting families that in many ways were very, very similar to Scottish families that I knew that I grew up in. And then blending that with Maori or Polynesian culture. And I had a whole load of Maori and Polynesian friends that, again, completely different backgrounds and just amazing people that I ended up bonding with through rugby and through a shared love of sport and health and fitness and travel. And really, I think that's probably what left the biggest mark on me as a young man growing up.
Well, I love that. I've been to Christchurch quite a bit and love New Zealand, just the most amazing place. I know exactly what you mean about the kind of the parallels between New Zealand and Scotland. It's so kind of unspoiled in both of those places if you're kind of out there and that kind of wonderful purity of the fresh air and the beautiful landscape and everything. So I can see why it felt like a home from home. But obviously lots of yacht owners going over to New Zealand for the America's Cup and, you know, a country that loves it. Boats and loves it sailing. They sail from when they're like pretty much able to totter off into the ship. what's your connection or your experience with yachting? Have you been on many boats? Have you chartered? Did you sail when you were growing up?
So it's exciting for me because it's really just developing, and there's a personal side and a professional side. So on the professional side, it's very much in its infancy. We've realized in the last few months how much opportunity there is in the space because, you know, perhaps that part of travel hasn't embraced content and social as much as it could. And perhaps there's an understanding, I hope, that all the raw materials are there because yachting and boats, you go to amazing, beautiful places. The physical act of taking that kind of travel is so empowering. It is so unique. But that hasn't necessarily translated into content that you see on digital and social channels. So from a professional standpoint, we're very, very excited now to be pushing harder into the industry. But from a personal standpoint, I mean, I've been on boats since I was young, not necessarily chartering them myself, but being with friends as I've gone through my sort of mid-20s into my early 30s, getting around lots of Europe has been on boats. And I think, again, anyone that's British, that's in the UK, that thinks about European summers, you know, you can't not think about some of these amazing places that you get to by boats. And the Greek islands, I've done a lot of the Greek islands by boat, a lot of Croatia as well. I was actually really fortunate to get out to Hvar in Croatia and some of those islands before they really became popular. So in my early 20s, I went out there and we did everything by boat, and it was just... it was just mind blowing. And I've done, as I've gotten a bit older, more of the kind of flagship sort of boating events and been to Cannes and been to Saint-Tropez and done those kind of experiences. And again, just love them personally and just excited about the opportunity that arises from them professionally now.
I love the Greek islands. I could go there literally every year. Absolutely. And just hop between them. To me, that I love the kind of freedom you get between being on a boat and seeing these amazing places and just being able to kind of, you know, plan your own itinerary around it. It's a great trip to do.
Absolutely.
And I'm kind of curious about what you said. So, you know, I think there is a case to be said that some of the boat brands, some of the yachting industry aren't maybe as digitally savvy as other people in the industry or are kind of looking for guidance there. Mm-hmm. What do you think, as someone who clearly, you know, you've worked with everything from tourist boards to different brands to hotels to individuals, you know, if you were to say, here's what the yachting industry needs to do, you know, here's how you can sell sailing, what's your kind of initial opinion of that?
I think it's short form video. And so, I mean, marketeers in the industry and owners, everybody knows about social media now, and everybody is hearing the buzzwords of creating content or becoming a content creator. But I think really I believe that the era of photographs of boats in nice places is past. It's been like that for so many years. Yes, because like if you think about the way that the advertising within this industry has been running, largely brochure and magazine driven, largely beautiful photos, which have existed for many, many years, being placed as ads into these brochures or magazines, where actually where consumers are spending their time. One in every 5 minutes in Europe that's spent on a mobile phone is spent on either Instagram or Facebook. The average person spends between 4 and 5 hours a day on their mobile phone. And so in the early days of this industry, certainly when I was trying to break into the space and having discussions with luxury hotels or luxury travel brands, there was a continued narrative that this is just the place for kids. This is just the place for young consumers.
Yeah.
This is just the tool that they use to frivolously sort of waste time or chat about nonsense. And the reality is now, these are the dominant media platforms in the world. If you look at what's happening in the news, the Facebooks and the Googles and the guys that own these big digital platforms are the ones that have gotten so big and so successful. The questions are being asked about how you really invest in these tools and how you generate returns from them. And so I think the boating and yachting industry at large hasn't invested as heavily as it could in short form social video, which performs on these platforms. And really, regardless of whether you are looking to build your brand or drive brand awareness, or if you're actually trying to drive sales, if you're not creating content for the platforms that consumers are spending their time, then you're really not in the place that you need to be to get them to see your message. And there are a whole host of very powerful insights coming out around the types of consumers that now use these products. So something like an Instagram is very heavily dominated by a millennial audience. And certainly when you look at the demographics of people that are using Instagram, they skew towards slightly older millennials. They skew towards individuals with above average household incomes. They skew towards individuals that travel more than normal consumers. They skew towards individuals that live around major metropolitan cities and have the kind of disposable income to invest in travel experiences. And I know that a large part of our success has been tapping into the fact that those consumers exist on these platforms, and we've been giving them the content that they want. But if you look at something like Facebook, the fastest growing cohort of users on Facebook is above 55s. These are individuals with more disposable income, the kind of individuals that are, you know, reconnecting with long lost friends and family members through Facebook, that you can then send very targeted ads to. And there really hasn't ever existed, I don't believe, in history, as powerful a marketing and targeting platform as Facebook. And if you are an owner that has a very, very specific type of customer, you can find them on Facebook with the right kind of tools. You can find them on Instagram. And I just think that's a big opportunity for the industry to embrace.
So if we take a case study of this in practice, then if I'm an owner and I've got a boat that's been around for a while, a charter boat, and I want to promote it, is your answer sort of video on Facebook and targeted?
Yes. So I think not necessarily Facebook, but definitely video. We absolutely live in a video driven world. And if I can be more specific, it is short form video. It's recognizing now that if you think about even your own consumption habits, when you read the news now, you more than likely read it on your mobile whilst you are walking to work, whilst you are on the way to doing something else, whilst you're picking up your children. The days of sitting down, putting aside an hour to read the newspaper, to stay at home, to watch the evening news, they just don't exist. All of that content has been bifurcated, and people are connecting across multiple different touch points. So what stands out on these platforms is video. And that could be whether you decide to advertise on BBC.com or New York Times, or if you're on social media, it really is video that drives that engagement. And I think especially for the boating and yachting industry, where the product is so incredibly visual and you have the raw materials to really make something exciting and something that people will want to watch. Static photos are great, but as I said, they've been done for decades past. Short form videos are really where I see the biggest opportunity. And I mean, it's not simple, and it's worth investing in trying to understand, but there are differences between a 30-second video that you would create to run on Instagram and a 15-second ad that you might do as the pre-roll on YouTube, or a 2-minute video that you might make to be an in-flight advertisement on Emirates Airways or British Airways. And so all of these different forms of short-form video, these are the nuances that I think are what the industry needs to start looking at and start investing in.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And let's talk a bit, because obviously, you know, business aside, you know how to take an amazing photo yourself. You know how to take amazing video yourself. That's what kind of, you know, I know that now you pull other people's pictures from all over the world on the main channel, but you can do that yourself. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what you thought of this, and that I'm researching a piece at the moment to do with different ways to document your trip. And if you speak to any of the kind of big adventure companies, and actually owners that have been out there and done it, you know, lots of people have been given the advice, you know, you enjoy the glaciers, you enjoy the humpback whales, hire a videographer, hire a photographer. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that can capture it for you. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Can you capture a moment and still enjoy it? Or do you think it's pretty sound advice that you have to get a professional on board to do it? Or if you are focusing on that, you can expect to enjoy the moment slightly less?
Yeah, I really don't think that it's enjoying the moment less. And I've certainly heard that maybe, you know, from an older generation that just consumes differently. I think today's consumer has no problem looking at content on their mobile phone, has no problem taking a minute to grab content on their phone. It's a human behavior. And whether you agree with it or you disagree with it, I just believe it is an inherent part of life now. And so I think we certainly from a business standpoint, Beautiful Destinations have done a number of partnerships with guys like Lindblad Expeditions, where we have put our photographers and videographers onto some of these expeditions. And I think it's brilliant. I think it's absolutely fantastic because the guests are then able to fully immerse themselves in whatever experience they have and have a professional third party person capture that content for them. So I think there'll always be a place there. I think always be a place for that there. I think that's also a growing industry, and it's something that I'm excited to see growing, whether it is, you know, Nat Geo photographers or whether it is this emerging young creative class of amazing content creators that works with Beautiful Destinations or actually even does it on their own. I think that's a huge growth area. I also think that now the tools are there to make amazing content very, very easily. And it's one of the things that I'm most passionate about talking about and sort of supporting when we think about this young creative community is many of these guys and girls, they didn't go to traditional film school. They don't work in traditional agencies. They are completely self-taught on YouTube or Reddit. They are going out there because they have a real passion for the space that they're getting into, and they are teaching themselves and teaching others through the communities that they build on digital and social. So you're finding individuals now who are able to design a campaign, shoot the campaign, produce the campaign, edit the campaign, do all the sound design, do all of the end-to-end production and deliver your final product and do it themselves. And so when we send out teams, we're sending out very, very light teams. And I think it's one of the big opportunities for boating and yachting, where obviously you have a limited amount of capacity on board. And so to send a huge production team where you know you have to give up, you know, five spaces to send lots and lots of different people, you just don't need to do that anymore. You can still get world-class sort of cinema-grade quality content with maybe one or two people. And that's an area that I think is only going to grow more.
That's interesting. Well, if people are planning their budgets for next year, they can take note of that. But from a more kind of amateur perspective, say I'm an owner and I just want a really great picture of my, you know, where I'm spending my Christmas. Mm-hmm. What are your basic, what are kind of three top tips for taking great pictures? Because like I said earlier, it sort of seems obvious, but I've seen my fair share of kind of terrible pictures that people have wanted to print in stories and things, and it's so frustrating because they really stand out differently compared to what photographers have taken. So what can people do if they just want nice memories of their trip, nice pictures of their boat? Obviously it's not that easy because it's moving, there's lighting. How would you navigate it?
Well, what we found from the travel standpoint is that there are just two really fundamentally good times of the day when you're going to get your best light, the golden hour. So, you know, looking at the hour just after the sun rises, where the environment, assuming that you're seeing a sunrise, the environment from a lighting standpoint is absolutely at its best. And then actually at the end of the day, the hour or two, the hour before and then the hour after the sun sets, those are some very, very simple things that people can do. And we do see a lot of mistakes being made when people will try to get their shooting done in the middle of the day. They'll go when it's the harshest light, when the sun is sort of at its strongest, and capture content then. So I think timing around it is just as a normal boat owner, that's a very simple thing to do. Also, if they can invest a little bit in some of the tools and technology available, so things like GoPros, which are very very simple and easy devices to use that you can use to get content in the water. You can dive in and you can shoot from underneath your boat from a different perspective where you don't have to be on board because they're fully waterproof. And they're now, I think the Hero 9, the most recent one, is as good a piece of technology for creating content as you will find, because you can get into the water, you can get it wet, and you can shoot from under the water and still get really, really quality content. Equally, from above the water and even above the boat itself, drones are now incredibly accessible. Certainly when I started BD, we were sending out drone operators, very challenging environments, very challenging technology. It used to be the world of only professionals, and it's now very much become accessible to amateurs and relatively inexpensive to get a decent drone. Some of them are as small as, if not just a little bit bigger than an actual mobile phone. So they're very easy to carry around, and you could just chuck them up, you know, pretty much anywhere. So those are the sorts of things that I'd be thinking about.
And talking about kit for a second, so I'm not paid by them or anything. I have a OnePlus.
Yep.
Phones. It seems like the video camera on that is pretty decent. Are our phones good enough, or would you always say, no, you still need a proper video camera if you want to get some proper video, or you need a GoPro, you need a drone?
They definitely are. They really are. And so actually, we when we send out our teams on our productions, we will always have an individual that is dedicated to getting content just on mobile. And so you may have an expensive Red camera and a full end, $100,000 piece of kit that will get you the big sort of cinematic stuff. But in those same shoots, you should absolutely be thinking about having someone that is a drone operator expert. We have even individuals now that are experts in first person view drones, where they're wearing headsets, and these are little micro drones that move at such an amazing pace that you can get content like you've never seen before. And then also individuals that just shoot on phones. And often what we'll find is, and this is in a non-professional realm as well, shooting on mobile phones does show that raw, authentic sort of behind the scenes version, view of what your experience is. And in many cases, if you then are putting that on social media to advertise, or even just to share what your boat or your experience is, very often it performs better. And so if you do have a look at the Beautiful Destinations account, you'll see that some of the most engaged videos we post are just a normal person just capturing that amazing travel experience and doing so on their phone.
And we said we'd talk a bit about this year, the weird year, as we would call it. What's it been like for you? Because I know, being stuck inside when I was, supposed to go to all these boat shows, supposed to go to all these amazing places, I feel like I've consumed more kind of inspirational travel content more than ever, because there's that kind of daydreamy aspect of it. Has it been a kind of bumper year for you guys, or has that dropped off? And second slightly trickier question, what do you think is going to happen next year? What can you sort of predict will happen based on your audience?
Yeah, of course. So on the one hand, we've been very fortunate, because exactly what you described, we've seen play out at a mass scale. We've seen many, many more people either be, obviously because they're forced to stay home, or just not going out and traveling, spending more time on social, spending more time on mobile. So we have seen really meaningful engagement increases and growth on our channels, as people are looking for those, those moments of wanderlust and those moments of travel inspiration. And it's almost been a number of different phases, because in the early phase of COVID, if you remember, we know in the UK, we used to go out and be clapping for NHS workers. And when I was in New York, at the time, you'd have people leaning out of their apartment windows and clanging pots and pans together just to show their appreciation. And some amazing content came out across that. And if you remember back in the early days of this, terrible pandemic, Italy was hit incredibly hard. So we were seeing some really heartwarming videos coming out of Italy of communities kind of coming together and even like singing together, and that kind of stuff, even though it wasn't direct travel content, was inspiring people to think about travel. And so we were seeing thousands and thousands of comments of people going, I cannot wait to get back to travel. Like, I cannot wait to get back and be there. So on the one hand, I guess the media and the channel sides of our business has grown. On the other hand, I'm sure, as many in the travel industry have faced the same challenge, our clients had stopped spending in the first half of the year, and completely understandably so. I mean, really, when we can't travel and when it doesn't make sense to market, then all of those things were held, and I understand that, and certainly we had a challenging first 6 months. But we've started to see a real change, actually, a real uptick. And I'd say the month and a half before vaccine news started to come out, we're starting to see leaders within travel and tourism actually stepping up and saying, listen, consumer confidence is starting to come back. There is a pent-up demand, which I think is the most exciting for all of us in travel, is that people didn't just decide they didn't want to travel. They still really want to travel. And I think even more so now that they've been restricted for the last year. So the pent-up demand is there, and we're starting to see clients come back now and increase their spending and start working with us again. So touch wood, things on the business side are looking very good for 2021. On the personal side, I think often people don't really understand the depth and the power of our industry, because people think about travel sort of being that that little bit of luxury, that little bit of escaping your day to day, and they think about the leisure context of travel, which of course is completely normal. But prior to COVID, one in 10 jobs in the world was in the travel industry. In the last 3 years, one in every five newly created jobs was in the travel industry. And this is trillions and trillions of dollars around the world of GDP being generated by an industry which provides these amazing, empowering experiences for consumers, then creates really sort of significant revenue generation for countries. And then if it's done right, and if it's looked at through a lens of sustainable development, then really does empower local communities, because there are there's a saying in global economics that the tourism industry is the ATM of the world, because it's the industry that the moment you land in the destination you're arriving to, money goes straight from your hands into the hands of local communities. And when you think about the ramp up time for building a factory or a manufacturing plant, or even a new infrastructure for roads and so forth, it's many, many years before that economic benefit is actually felt by the people that are in that community. But with travel, the moment you land, you pay for that taxi, you have that cup of coffee, you tip your waiter, all of those things instantly start to benefit people. So I think that's been lost. And of course, the economic numbers that are starting to come out from the World Travel and Tourism Council and the United Nations World Tourism Organization are showing very, very challenging losses in revenue for our industry that are then having real impact on people. So I'm hoping that all of this starts to turn in 2021. And now we're seeing vaccines coming out. We're seeing consumer confidence in the hygiene and safety standards that have been put in place by hotels and airlines, and certainly the cruise line industry that's starting to get there. I'm hoping that will put us in a position to be back to new forms of travel in 2021.
And in terms of destinations, I remember reading some comments of yours before about places that people always love to see, like the white and blue roofs of Santorini. Right. People always love that. But are there any places that you've seen an uptick in interest in that you can kind of say, you know what, I think next year this is going to be the new Croatia, or this is going to be the new Mediterranean? Where do you think is going to be everyone will be flocking to when they can?
Yeah, it's such a good question. So actually, it's a little bit, my answer is a little bit broader, because I haven't necessarily seen from the data specific destinations, but more general themes, and the themes being nature and non-city based destinations for many obvious reasons. People being cooped up inside, wanting to be able to get out and explore, wanting to be able to see nature, the inherent benefit of that also potentially being safer because of less interactions with people. Certainly we've seen, and I think it was last week, the Airbnb IPO, and in their IPO prospectus, really actually talking about real data that was showing more people were booking Airbnbs in remote locations and staying for longer periods of time as a direct consequence of what we've seen happening through COVID. And certainly in North America, where they talk a lot about their market, that's what they were seeing consumers doing. So I think destinations that lend themselves towards conservation, I think, are very, very well set up for a movement into sustainable travel, which is something I care deeply about, and I think is a fundamental shift that we're going to see in the industry. Destinations that are also set up to have an infrastructure that allows people to land in the main hub and very easily and very quickly get out to these remote or more nature-based destinations, I think, are going to be very successful. I've been hearing a lot of news around what's happening in the UAE, in Dubai, and in Abu Dhabi, who really have invested very, very heavily in a full end-to-end protocol from landing in the airport to the transport from the airport to the hotel experience, where certainly safety is put front and center. And I think broadly speaking across the industry, the majority of leading hoteliers, the majority of leading tourism destination marketers, and the majority of leading figures in the cruise and aviation industry have actually stepped up and made the investments in making their modes of transport or their destinations safer. I think the challenge is now actually just going to be convincing the consumers of where it is that they go. And certainly from a marketing standpoint, one of the challenges we're anticipating is that it will be the first time in the history of travel where, broadly speaking, the floodgates are going to open at around the same time. You know, everyone is going to start, you know, being able to market. And so whether you decide to go to this country versus that country or this city versus that city is going to be a function of who's spending the most marketing dollars.
Gosh, so that's something to think about. But it's interesting what you say about the sort of adventure, more sort of off the beaten track destinations, because that's something we're seeing in yachting already, is that, you know, I've spoken to a couple of the charter companies and they've said, you know, people are still booking, yacht owners are still traveling and have done throughout the pandemic, but they're not heading to the busy marinas and the beach clubs. They're looking for much more secluded places. And once they're there, they're happy to stay on their boat rather than, you know, going to and from shore a lot. And I wonder how long that kind of feeling of, oh, I don't want to be around lots of people and I want to be safe and secure. I wonder how long we'll hold on to that, if that's going to be something that lasts us for the next 5 years, or once things start opening up a bit, maybe it's something people will move on from very quickly.
It's very hard to say. I don't think there's really a way to, you know, categorically tell, but I think that the boating and yachting industry is certainly very well positioned to be a large part of the recovery and to be a large part of the comeback, because, as you said, people can enjoy amazing travel experiences with small groups of people that they know and they trust. They don't have to feel like they're getting onto, you know, commercial planes where they may be seeing or interacting with hundreds of people going through an airport and then hundreds of people on a plane that they don't know and they don't know where they've come from. Certainly there is that element of privacy and health security that I think is what a lot of travelers are looking for. I'm not at all surprised to hear that that from your industry you're seeing a continuation of yacht and charter owners like continuing to travel. That makes a lot of sense. And I really think that as the destinations that have meaningful natural resources and a sustainable tourism product start to then open themselves up to the boating and yachting industry, I can see that as a huge growth opportunity.
Well, fingers crossed, you know, we'll wait for next year with bated breath, but I think we're already starting to see the uptick on our end. The last thing I wanted to ask you about, just I know that you work with WWF as well. You're the second WWF ambassador we've had on the program. Nina Jensen, who used to work for WWF and is now the CEO of RevOcean, was one of the first people to come on the podcast. But I just wondered, sort of, what are you focusing on with them? And is any of that kind of ocean related, or is it more land based?
No, it's everything, actually. And it's exciting for me because the wider positioning is sustainable tourism, which is the idea of respecting local people, local communities, the environment, and the traveler themselves. And that wider mantra, I think, applies to everyone in travel and tourism, whether you're in planes, whether you're in boats, whether you're in hotels. And the thinking is really to try and educate people about how they can travel more sustainably. I think we are seeing now more and more decisions being made coming out of COVID through a sustainable lens. So questions being asked about what carbon footprint is, and WWF, certainly in the UK, has an amazing carbon footprint calculator that I'd highly encourage anyone who travels to just go and take a look, because you have the ability to see, you know, what your carbon footprint is. I'm also an ambassador for Gold Standard, which is, it's a partner agency that was set up by WWF 16 years ago. And they are one of the official accreditation agencies that allow you to offset all of your carbon footprint. So you can go and you can physically pay to remove the pounds of carbon that you've put into the atmosphere from your travels. So also something that I'd highly encourage people to do. And they're a not-for-profit as well that really focuses on how we drive a sustainable future. So I think from a travel standpoint, not only are we seeing entrepreneurs and business leaders stepping up and putting together travel product that is more environmentally conscious, more focused on the environment, but actually also more sustainable for the long term, because people are realizing that if we don't address the climate challenges that we're seeing today, if we do continue having mass over tourism in certain destinations, if we do continue focusing on short-term revenue, there won't be a tourism product in the future. And I think the ocean, you know, almost as much as any other part of the world, but certainly it's gotten a lot more press, has seen challenges with plastics, has seen challenges with direct impacts from the warming of the environment. And there are plenty of charities that have kind of stepped up and plenty of actually high profile figures in the world that have stepped up and said, we have to fundamentally do something about this. And again, I just think that's incredibly positive. And anything that I can do to help raise awareness of that and put that in front of our audience of millions or support organizations like WWF, I'm very proud to do that.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like you're doing great work with them. And if you would be a good thing to end the year on, you should check out your carbon footprint, offset it. Absolutely. It's an easy thing to do for anyone listening.
It is.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy. It's been fascinating talking to you and looking forward to looking at even more beautiful photos over the Christmas break stuck at home.
Thank you, Charlotte. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you in 2021.